Hello, Muppets and our loyal listeners. Welcome back to another episode with Psych Mike. I'm Lulu.
And I'm Adam.
And before we formally jump into all of that amazing content, I would like to shamelessly plug some of the events that MUPA is hosting. So next week, we have our APA 7 workshop coming up. We also have a very special workshop with Betsio, which is a mental health organization. So we're organizing a workshop that's in relation to suicide prevention. Tickets are available on TryBooking. So if you head to our Instagram and click on our bio, you'll find all the information you need there. We also have a few other exciting events coming up, which is the Next Step workshop. So if you're interested in knowing more about honors and you're potentially interested to become a psychologist, or if that's something you're thinking about, then I would highly recommend you to attend this Next Step workshop, which will be facilitated by Adam and Warren. In addition, we also have our industry expo coming up in October, but stay tuned for more. We'll have over 50 speakers coming in.
One last note about the Next Step workshop. If you aspiring, budding honors student wants to know what the entry wham is into honors, I would recommend you to drop by. Is it 85? Is it 95? Is it 102? You never know. Come along and find out.
Or else.
Today we have a special guest. We have Professor Brock Bastian. Brock is a professor at the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences at the university. His research covers a lot of areas from morality, ethics, pain, and well-being. And today we will actually be talking about the psychology of pain, why pain might be actually good for us, adaptive to our mental health, why some cultures might differ with respect to their responses to pain, and how we might reframe our thoughts about pain and adversity. Would you like to tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, what would you like to know?
Maybe a bit about your research.
Sure. So, I mean, broadly, I guess my research, I would classify it as focusing on morality, the psychology of moral decision-making or behavioral ethics, as I sometimes call it, as well as, you know, well-being, happiness, some of those sorts of aspects as well. So covers, I guess, a few different areas. Yeah.
Awesome. For context, I think I might have mentioned this in the email. I took trends with you a few years back.
Yep.
And I remember your lecture about pain.
Yep.
And it was really eye-opening because it's like the things you talk about are things that like implicitly I kind of knew, I guess. Mm. It's kind of like, no pain, no gain, if you want to oversimplify it.
Yep.
But I never thought about it explicitly. And from that point onward, I kind of almost had this fascination with first why pain might be good for us.
Yep.
And why the narrative that you should always chase more pleasure, maybe you could call that hedonism, might not be so good for us. So maybe if you could elaborate a bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think broadly as humans, I mean, we're motivated to minimize pain and to maximize pleasure. I think that that's sort of a fairly rational and reasonable place to sort of fall. It makes sense. But I think the issue or the, you know, the problem is with this idea that in fact, you know, life would be ideal if we eradicated pain completely and only experienced pleasure. And when you think about it, that's probably not really something that sounds too feasible, but it does appear to be part of the narrative sometimes. And this idea that, you know, pain is just an unpleasant experience detracting from our lives. And you know, again, if we could just be more happy all of the time, that we'd actually be better off. And I guess my argument is, well, that doesn't really seem to be the case. You know, in many ways, our research has found that focusing on or chasing or prioritizing, you know, in ways where we try to maximize happiness in life tends to backfire. So, in fact, you tend to become less happy. In life, when you make happiness a goal, it doesn't tend to work so well for a variety of reasons we can talk about if you like. On the flip side of that, I suppose, I don't think it's how much we value happiness that is actually the problem or which causes the problem that we experience. I think it's more the sort of concomitant way in which we devalue painful experiences or see them as interrupting that goal. And so when we, again, being more happy is great, but when we then experience inevitably some of those less happy moments in life, the way we respond to and react to those is defined a little bit by how we see those in terms of their value. And their value, if they're defined by, well, they're interrupting my ability to be happy, they're just detracting from my life. I think, well, firstly, that's not a very adaptive way of responding to anything and limits our ability to, I guess, think of ways to accommodate that into our lives in a meaningful sort of way. But I think also it underestimates or sort of forgets the fact that in actual fact we do need these sorts of contrasts in life. And in fact, having some pain is a really important avenue through which we can realize and experience pleasure. And again, you know, without that, we really couldn't have the kind of pleasure or happiness that we're seeking in life. And then when you sort of start to look at it from that perspective, you also start to come up with a whole lot of examples where we actually are seeking out unpleasant and painful experiences in life. We just don't often call it that because we focus on the outcome, which is increased happiness instead. But actually the way we get there or the route via which we find that happiness necessarily involves elements of discomfort, unpleasantness, pain, difficulty, challenge, etc.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you're saying that devaluing pain might feel like when we do feel pain or discomfort, we're kind of like not meeting a goal of living a happy life. Is that one of the ideas?
Yeah, I think certainly in that perspective of happiness being very important and the ideal state, that sort of, I guess, frames pain in that very negative way. It just forgets the importance or even our own use of it often in life to achieve happiness. Yeah.
Yeah. And beyond that, you're saying that pain has some distinct benefits for our psychology potentially.
Well, I suppose I'm saying at a very broad level that without pain, we can't be happy. Mm-hmm. So if you want to sort of see, well, what's the benefit of pain? Well, it allows us to be happy. Well, that's sort of a fairly big one. But there are a range of avenues through which that can occur and a range of ways in which we sort of find that impacting on our well-being. The most basic of which is survival, right? So, I mean, without pain, you don't survive. People with a congenital inability to experience pain don't live very successful lives, tend to, live shorter lives. There's injury and whatnot. So, pain is very important for our survival. But again, there are a whole lot of other ways in which, pain does contribute to our happiness and a range of sort of, I suppose, details around that. But the broader picture is that without that contrast, at a very high level, without that contrast, I think it's very hard to experience ongoing pleasure or happiness. It's not something that we can really, I think as humans, we need that variation. We need the ups and the downs. You're just having always up. It starts to, well, I think we start to become a bit numb to it probably.
Yeah, for sure. So if that's the case, if it's clearly quite obvious when you think about it, that some level of discomfort is important for you, you probably don't need to do a PhD to understand that, right?
No.
Well, why is this narrative emerged that you always want to reduce pain? You don't, why does everyone say, okay, so you have a tiny bit of pain, I don't know, stay at home or take a pill. And why, even myself, I have this implicit kind of like, if I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable, I'm going to back off for a bit rather than just reevaluate for a second and go on.
Yeah.
Well, why is that so prevalent?
It's a good question, and I don't have all the answers to that. I think it's a cultural sort of message or milieu that we see. Mm-hmm. I don't have all the answers to that, but I do think it's probably, it's, at very least it's got to do with, I guess, our ability to treat pain. So, in fact, pain killing has only been around for about, I think it's 150 years or something, right? So before that, if you needed surgery, just a stiff cocktail was pretty much what you had. No, it wasn't nice. But there's an account of this woman who has a breast removed, and she talks about, the stiff cocktail and 9 men dressed in black to hold her down, and she passes out some way through that. So I'm very glad that we've got anesthetics. I've been under surgery and would hate to think what it would be like without that.
That would suck.
Yeah, so our ability to, I suppose, deal with and remove pain has increased, and I think maybe in a way it's pretty easy to become reliant on that, or in a sense start to see, well, why should I have it if I don't have to have it, and to remove it in that sort of way. And I guess the medicalization then of pain means that we see it in that kind of context rather than in all the other sorts of contexts that we might seek it out as part of our day-to-day living. So, you know, I think that's one. I think the other one is that that sort of focus on positivity and happiness. It's probably a range of avenues, even through domains of psychology, that may have been inadvertently the kind of clear message that people got somewhere.
Is that positive psychology?
Well, yeah. I mean, not properly understood, but improperly applied. That's exactly how I think it's sort of, you know, become the focus in that way. But even beyond that, I think that perhaps in our sort of, you know, in our modern world, in the rather sort of consumerist mindset, we kind of have this perspective, well, I should be able to live an ideal life. I should be able to, you know, make those choices in life where I can actually achieve all that I want and have what I want. And of course, what I want is to feel good most of the time. And so, well, why can't I feel good all of the time? And so I suppose in a way you can kind of see how that narrative might emerge. That's more an anecdotal sort of analysis than any kind of clear evidence that that's how it's happened. But, yeah, I think you can kind of look at the culture and see, well, you know, there is a bit of that. I mean, I think it's shifted a little bit from when I started some of this work. We now have the word toxic positivity, which wasn't around before.
Yeah.
So that's emerged, and I think that's sort of something that, again, is a bit of a backlash to some of that sort of cultural push to the importance of happiness. But yeah, I think you know, in many ways, we probably have just lost the language to talk about pain in a productive way, and we do sort of see it again in this very medicalized sense. And I think the other thing is we tend to restrict the term to these sort of narrow kind of definitions around injury and illness when, I don't know, I mean, you know, I'm going to go tomorrow morning, if it's not riding, I'm going to go, you know, on a long bike ride with a bunch of other mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra, and we're going to, you know, I mean, it's going to hurt, right? That's the point, right? If it didn't hurt, it wouldn't do it, ultimately, right? It wouldn't be challenging. It wouldn't feel good afterwards. There wouldn't be a sense of sort of enjoyment or pleasure from that if it didn't challenge, and if your legs weren't kind of worn out at the end, and there wasn't something to push against, which is the pain, right? Ultimately, that's what it is. But we don't kind of refer to it as that. Of course, there are many other ways. And fun parks wouldn't be fun if they weren't scary. You know, we don't call that pain, but it's certainly not pleasure. You know, being fearful and scared and feeling that sense of trepidation, that's not what you call pleasurable, but it becomes pleasurable in a fun park context. So there's actually a paper by Paul Rosen called Benign Masochism, which is this idea, you know, that actually, and he documents all these different kinds of ways that we sort of seek out some of these experiences, and he shows that people actually get their maximal enjoyment from these innately unpleasant experiences just at the point they can't stand it anymore. And that's where they find it maximally enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think, you know, you can just sort of see all these different contexts where we actually get pleasure from engaging in innately unpleasant experiences.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what might be happening, people, society, whatever you want to call it, we've been potentially medicalizing or pathologizing pain. So whenever you spot it, it's like, oh, shit, this isn't supposed to be here, rather than this is just like a normal part of the human experience.
That's right.
Is that the case?
Yeah, I think so. We've limited our understanding of it. That's right. When we do see it, we see it in that sort of context. So, you know, and again, it's good to be able to eradicate some forms of pain. You'd prefer not to have a headache. I'd prefer not to have a headache, right? But again, even those forms of pain that we don't seek out, that we don't sort of would prefer not to have, I think, you know, the inability to have those, I think, would also be problematic for our well-being, not only because of survival, but I think, you know, sometimes, I don't know, sometimes you go through experiences in life that you don't choose, you would like rather not have, and if you could choose to even rewind your life, you'd still choose not to have them, but they still do contribute in really important ways. You know, so we certainly see some work by Mark Seary, which shows that, you know, people who've had this a moderate level of adverse experiences, and these aren't just, you know, scary rides. These are losing parents and going through war and other sort of, you know, really potentially quite traumatizing kinds of experiences. But he sort of shows that actually having a moderate level of these is really important for resilience. It's important for how people even respond to a cold presser task and how long they can keep their hand in that bucket. So, you know, in a sense, you build resilience through some of these sorts of experiences, even if you prefer not to have them and even if you didn't choose them.
Yeah. So if I understood it correctly, it's the U function, where like a low level of pain or adversity gives you the least amount of psychological resilience or robusticity or whatever. And then a high amount also makes you like that. But then in the middle, it's kind of like you're golden.
That's right. Yeah. So too much isn't probably, you know, good. I mean, you know, we know PTSD and trauma and those sorts of things are certainly not adding to resilience or the quality of life.
Well, in saying that, is all pain created equal? Is there a difference between, and this might sound a bit odd, voluntary or elected pain? So say you go to the gym and do a really hard workout, or you choose to take on a really challenging job that might lead you to somewhere, it might not, but it definitely builds your skill and your work capacity.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, you're losing a loved one or you have a really bad injury. Is there a difference between these types of two types of pain on your psychology?
Well, I think the first type is more tolerable, right? If you choose it, if you have control over it, we already know that you can actually, in fact, it reduces your experience of pain to have control over it. So, so, I mean, I think that that's certainly more tolerable and a sort of pain we prefer to experience. But I don't think ultimately in terms of what it does for us or what we might take away from it, that it's actually that different. You know, I think going through, you know, losing a loved one, well, that's inevitable. Right, it's never not going to happen. So we're all going to experience it. So then, I guess, what do we take away from it? How do we make sense of it? How do we lean into that and draw from what we can from it, as opposed to simply see it as a bad, terrible thing that shouldn't have happened? And I don't think that's adaptive, right? That's not going to help me to cope with that experience by just thinking it's a bad, terrible thing. I need to find something in there that I can draw on, even if it's, you know, the so-called silver lining, whatever. But I need to find something that I can draw on to manage that well. And I think the narrative around it, when it is just viewed as detracting from our life and it'd be better if we didn't have it and it's terrible that it's here, that just doesn't really help. And a narrative around, well, look, this is really hard, but what can I take from it moving forward, is a much better narrative. And I think finding those elements of that experience, and again, I've often, you know, some of the research and other ways of communicating that, I've often wondered how people with chronic pain might respond to it, and whether they'd be quite annoyed with me with, you know, all of this. But actually, they well, at least the ones that have ever communicated with me, have said, look, I totally get this, and that makes a lot of sense, and I find it really useful. Because if you've got to tolerate pain, well, you want to have some tools.
So interesting. How does this relate to ACT?
Quite closely. Yeah. I'm in another aspect of my life, I work with ACT and see clients. I think a lot of it, in fact, I was sort of doing some training in ACT, early in my career. And I think a lot of my thinking has been a bit shaped by that, to be honest.
It seems like it.
Yeah, and I find it very useful. I mean, again, I think CBT is very useful, and we do need to change how we think about things in order to manage them better, but there's some things we can't change. So how do you relate to those things in a way that helps you to manage them better?
So for those who might not be informed about ACT and all that in general, would you mind talking a bit about how maybe the philosophy of ACT and how it uses potentially adversity or not so good experiences to help people adapt?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm probably more a surface level, ACT philosopher, if you like. But I mean, really, it's the key word there is acceptance. That's the key word, right? So, that notion of acceptance is about how do you relate to things you can't change, and struggling with them only makes it worse. And so when you realize that, and I think, you know, again, the CBT approach can, sometimes you need to step away from that, because reframing everything in a different sort of sense, trying to struggle to find the positive in this thing may not always work. And then you need to think, well, how do I relate to it? If I can't reframe it in a way which makes it better, then I need to accept it. And I think that's where these two sort of approaches are actually quite useful. So if I need to, I suppose acceptance is that key piece there. I guess there's a few good illustrations of this, because often we need to accept particularly our internal states, right? So that often we try to control things that we don't like externally. So if I don't like my pot plant where it is, I'll pick it up and I'll move it. But if I don't like the thought that I'm having, trying to pick it up and move it doesn't work. It makes it worse. We've probably all heard of the white bear effect. The more you try not to think about white bears, the more you think of white bears. So control strategies don't work internally in our minds. So ACT is, I think, really useful for thinking, well, how do we relate to thoughts we don't want to have or that are there? you know, do we struggle and try and remove them, or do we actually just accept, well, that's a thought? And in fact, that acceptance then allows us to let it go because we're not hanging on to it. We haven't hooked into it, if you like, to use a bit of that language. I guess it's the same with emotions. So there's a great analogy of the quicksand. So most people sort of know that, and I think it's funny that most people know this because most people have never seen quicksand, but we seem to know what to do in quicksand, which is to lie, you know, to not struggle and to lie flat, to establish as much contact with our body with the surface of that quicksand as we can so that we don't sink into it. And it's the same with those internal emotional states. You want to establish contact, you don't want to struggle. And the more you sort of get to know what you're feeling and understand it rather than try and reduce it and struggle with it, that's often the best way to actually manage that emotion rather than exacerbate it and make it worse. And, you know, if I wake up and I'm having a blue day today, the more I just accept this is a blue day, probably the next day I'll be less blue. The more I sort of struggle with it and think, why am I feeling this way? This isn't any good. This is a problem. What's wrong with me? Probably the next day I'll feel even more blue. So I think it's that sort of principle.
Yeah. So you want to accept negative emotions as they come, not necessarily fight against them.
Not necessarily. I mean, some of their, I mean, yeah, not necessarily a fight against them. Certainly listen to them, though. Mm. I mean, I don't think it's about just saying, oh, well, you know, it is what it is. Sometimes there's really important information attached to them as well.
It's true.
Guilt is about, well, maybe I need to do something here. I should probably act to repair maybe something I've done wrong, or anger might be important to know that I need to act on something externally and perhaps address an issue with somebody else or something in the environment. So these emotions have a lot of information. And of course, the more that we accept that's how I'm feeling, the more we can actually get that information from those emotions versus when we're struggling with them, we're not really listening to them. Yeah. So we actually get a lot more information. And of course, if I was to, you know, I would say that all the information, in fact, the emotions that come with the most information are the unpleasant and negative, so-called negative emotions. The positive ones just give us the old proverbial thumbs up and tell us we're doing well.
Yes. So do you think that we are kind of like almost ignoring the fact that negative emotions contain some valuable information? You know, anger might tell you that you like something not so good has happened to you by someone.
Yeah.
And alike. Do you think that we tend to just focus on the experience of the emotion itself at the cost of, you know, what does this actually tell me about my environment, about my behavior?
Well, particularly when we have that narrative that, why am I feeling this way? I shouldn't feel this way. There's something wrong with me. Mm. I talking to people over the pandemic, I had a number of people say, look, I don't know what's wrong with me, Brock. I'm not coping the way I normally do. I feel more depressed and sad. And there's nothing wrong with you. You're in the middle of a pandemic, and what this is telling you is you're in the middle of a pandemic. That's just what that is, right? It's nothing wrong with you. But I think that narrative we've got suggests that there's something wrong with us if we move across into that unpleasant side of our emotional circumplex. But actually, it's there for very good reasons. We don't have those unpleasant emotions just because they're troublesome. We have them because they're valuable and they're adaptive. In fact, you know, if we couldn't panic, we wouldn't probably survive. Probably the ones who did survive were those of us with big amygdalas. We could all panic and we got away from the danger, and that's why we're here. So I think there's a lot of value, evolutionarily speaking, in our unpleasant and negative and painful emotions. But when you just see them as a problem or as something that's wrong with me or why am I feeling happier, then you don't get any of that value. You don't see it. You don't find that information. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So literally listen to your emotions. It's not a slogan. It's a prescription. You need to listen to your emotions. What are they telling
particularly
you?
Particularly the unpleasant ones.
Particularly, right. Yeah. I mean, when you're happy, it's just keep going.
Yeah, thumbs up. Well done. Good stuff. Yeah, which you want to sort of hopefully have that 80% of the time.
Yes.
It's like feedback, right? If you're getting feedback from people, you hope you're getting positive feedback 80% of the time. If you're getting positive feedback 100% of the time, well, you know, there's not much you can do. There's nowhere to grow. There's no actionable points.
That's true.
There's nothing to develop from. So it's that uncomfortable, unpleasant feedback that helps you to know how you can be better. And I think it's the same with your emotions.
Yeah. I want to circulate back a bit to culture. I know we kind of like talked about it for a moment or two. Mm. And we also talked about the narrative thing, how the current narrative, maybe especially in the West, is painting negative experiences, pain, negative emotions as potentially problematic. Is this unique to the West? Is it different in other countries?
It's hard, I guess, in some ways. And it is hard to make that a strong claim around that because the cultures are becoming so mixed.
Yes.
And the Western culture is probably the one which gets the most airplay everywhere, right? But I think certainly we do see that, for example, in what you might call, well, want a better word, East Asian cultures, somewhat collective cultures, there is a less of a tendency to focus on the sort of importance of positive feelings there tends to be more comfort or acceptance of unpleasant experiences. So it's certainly there's a range of reasons for why that might be the case. We unpack those in one of our papers, looking at the prevalence rates of disorder across particularly sort of Asian, East Asian countries and Western countries, America and Australia and others, and then sort of drawing on some of what we know around other differences around emotion regulation and response to negative emotion across those countries, hypothesize that perhaps some of those sorts of, culturally mediated capabilities or orientations might explain perhaps why people respond more poorly to negative emotions in Western cultures compared to other. And our analysis was focused on East Asian cultures, but East and the West is a bit of a crude distinction, but, you know, one that cultural psychology has drawn on for many years. So we sort of use that, yeah.
Can you unpack that a bit with crude distinction, but how East and Western cultures might differ with the response to pain and negativity?
There's a range of things. The ones that we drew on in that particular paper were, well, firstly, and we actually used some of cultural research from back in around the sort of 1980, when America was very interested in Japan and Japan was very interested in America. And so, there was a lot of research going on around, well, what are these differences and what do they mean? And one of the things certainly from that sort of, and again, it's been drawn back into, the Greek sort of philosophies that have formed and underpinned a lot of Western culture through to the sort of Confucian philosophies that have underpinned sort of more of that East Asian culture. And so there's a difference in the tolerance for contradiction, which is one of those. So there's certainly research showing that Westerners try to solve for contradiction, whereas East Asians are more likely to accept a contradiction as just a part of life. And then you can map that onto studies showing that, in fact, in more East Asian countries, you get less of a negative correlation between positive and negative emotion. Mm. So those things sort of can co-occur, if you like.
Whereas mixed emotions.
Yeah, they're more likely to have mixed emotions, whereas in Western cultures, you find that there's more of a negative relationship. So if I'm feeling positive, I'm less likely to report negative emotion and vice versa. So it's sort of this hydrotic relationship between them. So that contradiction or acceptance of it seems to be one aspect we suggested. Change. So there's again work showing that there tends to be an acceptance or almost a prediction that things are going to change in East Asian cultures, whereas in Western cultures people tend to sort of have this thought process that things are going must continue in a linear fashion. Whereas East Asians are more likely to predict, well, if it's going up, it's going to come down. That sort of way of thinking. And I suppose that idea of change, things will change, makes emotions easier. So if I have a blue day, if I think, well, oh God, this is going to continue, that's hard to respond well to versus this might change. Again, that basic belief is likely to impact. And again, there's been work showing that the beliefs about change and beliefs about emotions changing do predict more adaptive functioning is a large study in college students showing this. And the other one is sort of understand their self in context. I think this is more complex but interesting, where I think as Westerners we tend to see, if we have these negative emotional states, we tend to see them as something about ourselves. There's something about us, and this indicates a little bit about what's who I am and my identity in a way. Whereas when the self is understood in context, I'm much more likely to say, well, I'm feeling bad, but I understand myself as connected to my context, and therefore it's probably because of these other things that are going on around me. So I'm going to pay attention to context, and we also see at a very low level, again, based on some of this cross-cultural research, that East Asians tend to pay more attention to context than do. So again, I think putting yourself in context allows for a little bit more of that maybe self-distancing. I can step back outside of myself rather than feel sort of enshrouded in my own experiences, and then be able to get that perspective, see myself in that context and be able to then choose how I might best respond. So, you know, that there are three things we picked up on. There's also other work looking at other factors that seem to exist. So, it's a complex picture. But yeah, it does appear to be some cultural factors that are impacting on how people respond to painful, difficult, negative experiences in life.
I see. So people with this more, let's call it East Asian cultural mentality, not necessarily people from East Asia, and they're a bit more psychologically flexible when it comes to perceiving adverse events or negative emotions.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I give that lecture, many East Asians disagree with me vehemently. This is the case. So whether it's it's obviously not true for everybody. And but I mean, certainly drawing from the theory and the evidence we've got, that does seem to be where it's pointing. Yeah,
I see.
Yeah,
what are happiness cultures?
Well, I suppose that it's a term that we've sort of used to describe cultures that place a high value on happiness, and that really sort of, that I suppose see this as an important goal, or, there's been work showing that there's individual differences in this. So some people might value happiness more than others. I guess what we then did was look at this at more a cultural level and think, well, are there sort of some cultures that might value happiness more than others? And I think we certainly know based on the World Happiness Index, there are some cultures or I suppose countries that are higher in happiness. Whether they value happiness more or not concomitantly with that, it's not clear. But I suppose, even the focus on measuring this is an interesting, recent phenomenon. It really is just defined by cultures that, where there is this sort of strong messaging around happiness. And I think a lot of it's implicit. I think it comes through advertising. So probably the more you're advertised to, the more you kind of see people looking happy, placed next to products that are being sold, because of course putting sad faces next to products doesn't really work as a sales tactic. But also social media, I think that can be the case. I think again some interesting nuances to that as well. So I think Australia is a bit of a happiness culture in some ways. Yeah. But then I also find that culturally people always pick up that when they ask me how I'm doing, I say not bad. And they're like, oh, so not good. I'm like, no, good, just not. We also understate things too in Australia. So, I think there's a lot of nuances to this. I think the UK could be a bit of a happiness culture, but also they have this sort of stiff upper lip as well when it comes to dealing with sort of difficulty and pain, which is different. And I think probably stereotypically America is probably the kind.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking. That's a big one.
That's a big one.
It's like the happiness culture.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Even trying to translate thinking into that culture, it doesn't all. It's actually quite hard, because I think that there is a particular focus or way of thinking about happiness in America, which is different to the rest of the world.
When I think about, well, are there any negative consequences, negative outcomes of overvaluing, not necessarily valuing, but overvaluing happiness, completely putting it on a pedestal. Yeah. I think about American culture and whatever's been propagated in society, probably a lot around advertising and things of that nature. And just like the cultural makeup of America, it's kind of like go chase the American dream. Yeah. The idea of so much autonomy, freedom, independence. I think, and I might get this wrong because like politics and history aren't my strong suits, but there's something in the American Constitution or a legal doctrine about happiness being a God-given right or something to that effect.
Yep, yep.
So it's so almost fundamentally baked into the culture of the U.S. And I'm sure there must be something bad about or not really helpful about putting so much of an emphasis on that.
And I mean, of course, it goes both ways, doesn't it? So, I mean, we often want to, I innately feel like I want to criticize rampant individualism, but then when you look at the data, people in individualistic countries report more happiness. I don't know if that means they're more happy necessarily, but, on all measures of well-being, they tend to be doing better than people in high collectivism cultures. So I don't know what that necessarily means. I feel like I want to say that there's going to, that shouldn't be the case, but when we look at the data, it seems to be. But I do think, and again, we're talking very stereotypically here. So I think it's important, because I think there's there's many Americans who don't think this way or don't respond to the world in this way or don't hold these values. But again, taking that sort of rather stereotypical approach to this, I think one of the differences perhaps is that I think in the States there is this sort of, I guess, psychology around you need to be worth knowing. And in fact, so this comes through in the sort of self-deprecating humor, which actually doesn't work very well in America.
It's more of a British thing.
It's a very British thing. It's a bit of an Australian thing. In fact, it's sort of changing a little bit too, because there's the what do you call it when you take someone else down? What's the
tall poppy syndrome?
No, it's a form of humor. Anyway, there's a particular word for it when you kind of and I think the humor actually works more in that way. It's more about kind of having a shot at someone, then them having a reasonable shot back at you, which is quite different, I think. Whereas, I think it's becoming a bit of our culture too. When you burn someone, right?
Yes,
you burn people or you burn yourself, right? And so it's actually a bit different, I think, in the States compared to say the UK, and we're maybe somewhere in between. But I do think there's that sort of tendency to need to demonstrate your worth and to show people that you're worth knowing. And that's, I suppose, about being able to articulate your positive attributes and your positive traits and what makes you worth knowing effectively. That's where that self-deprecation doesn't work so well, because people get uncomfortable about it. They're like, why are you telling me that? I want to like you, but that doesn't help me like you. Whereas in Australia, people will like you a little bit more because you did that in the UK. So I don't know. I mean, that's just picking up on cultural threads really, but yeah, there's a range of things that seem to come through, and I suppose happiness and positivity and sort of demonstrating those qualities might be more important in a culture where you feel the need to do that.
Mm. What about in Australia? I know you said that Australia is also a bit of a happiness culture, but it doesn't seem to be just a copy-paste of the US.
No.
How are we doing in terms of, let's say, overvaluing happiness versus accepting pain?
Well, I'm not sure I can do a sort of national scorecard on it right here.
In general terms.
I don't know. We certainly, when we look at the data, we would place happiness, we would place Australia with America. So I think, when we draw those broad cultural comparisons, Australia gets lumped in with the West. So I think we're certainly sort of in that sort of echelon, if you like, in terms of probably being a bit of a happiness culture. There are sort of, again, those unique elements of the culture which perhaps do allow for a little bit more of an adaptive relationship to unpleasant experiences and pain in life. But, yeah, I'm not sure I could say how we're going. I mean, generally we're going well, right? But maybe we could do a bit better.
Yeah, yeah. You also commented about, I think we've been talking a lot about the cultural thing, but that doesn't have a lot of nuance. But what about at the level of the individual, what might be some or even one important factor, variable, that might predict how well you can cope with adversity and pain?
I would say it's your willingness or your preparedness, your acceptance, which is really the willingness part, to have these elements of you. They're inevitable, right? We're all going to have them. So how prepared are you? Do you see it as a failure on your part, or do you recognize that this is a little bit how life is, and it's more how you respond to it rather than whether or not you have it that actually I think defines how that's going to impact on you or your well-being. So I would say it's that ability to relate to these things in an adaptive way, not to struggle with them. I think we some people do that quite well, other people find it much harder, and I think often that's what we're teaching people is, how do you relate to these things in a manner that allows you to function well in life, because they are inevitable. We're not going to go through life without pain and difficulty and hardship. It's just part of it. So then you need to work out how you're going to relate to that in an adaptive, even positive way if you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Something a bit more practical I might ask you. Mm-hmm. Let's say we're speaking about a young person, someone who might be listening to this podcast, and they want to know, how do I become more resilient? I feel like I'm young. I'm not that strong. I've been through a few things in high school, maybe a little bit of university, had a little bit of hardship here and there, but nothing to write home about. How do I get more resilience? How do I become the tough man or woman that is able to cope with early adulthood?
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you an answer. I will preface it by saying I'm not sure we really know how to build resilience. I think resilience is one of those things we can measure, but how you really build it and how you develop it is a little bit difficult to know. So it's a bit of the holy grail. If we could work it out, we'd probably be doing it, flat out. But I think, probably I would say that to build resilience, it was very hard to know what you're capable of, what you can do. And I suppose, in some ways we need to know what we're capable of. We need to know what we can do, what we can handle, in order to be able to step forward in situations where those risks are there and to be able to manage them without that fear. So I think you do need to expose yourself to some of these experiences in life. So, I suppose, to get up and give that presentation, if you step away from that, again, we might step away from it, but then I think we've got to find ways to step back forward into that experience and give ourselves that leeway to perhaps fail, not get down on ourselves if we haven't been able to step up and give that presentation. But once we actually do and we continue to try to, when we do and we succeed, and then we realize, well, hang on a sec, I can do that. And of course, we take that forward and we're able to apply that to other situations in life and I think even probably cross-pollinate between one type of activity and another. I think you sort of see evidence of this. So, I think we have to find those sort of boundary points and to push towards them, if not even past them a little bit, but just not too far past them, because, of course, traumatizing ourselves and experience sort of abject failure because we overestimated everything is not great either. You don't want to put yourself in that position, but I suppose there's a bit of wisdom in knowing where can I push myself to and what's going to give me the feedback that I need to keep going. But I would say, at least anecdotally, that's probably, I think, how you would build that capacity or build your own knowledge of your capacities. I often refer to this, I'm showing my age, but, back in the day of IKEA when it first started, there used to be this Perspex box, and in the Perspex box was this chair, and this chair was being pushed by this machine, and the machine had this counter on it. And so you could walk past and you'd see, 750,000 or something like this, and it would just keep pushing 750,001, right? And so what was the purpose of this? And the purpose of it was to show what the chair was made of. It was to show what value the chair had and that it was tough, that it was resilient, that it could withstand me sitting on it 750,000 times before it would break and maybe more. So then I felt more confident to know, I know what that chair's value is. And I think it's the same with us, right? It's very hard if you don't have something you're pushing against to know what your value is, so what you can achieve. So we have to keep challenging ourselves, I think.
Yeah. So just like the chair, you need to push yourself so you know your limits. You have confidence in yourself.
Know your limits, know your value, know what you're made of. Yeah, I think you have to. And that's also, that's also where you get pleasure and enjoyment from, because, again, it's sometimes the, stepping into that anxiety, that fear, that trepidation, when you come out the other side of it, that's where you get that lift and that sort of sense of happiness and fulfillment, meaning. For having pushed into something that was difficult, whatever that is, I think. And if you don't, and if you always stay away from that, you always steer away from it, well, you miss out on that sense of, I suppose, enjoyment and pleasure you get at the other side of it. But you also miss out on knowing what you're capable of.
So push yourself, but don't go over the limit.
Yeah, be wise, and know when to sort of step away, know when to say no. Know when it's time to say, look, that's enough for me. Absolutely, I think that you've got to also have that awareness and apply it with a good deal of wisdom. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, I think that was really great. And thanks for coming to the podcast today.
No problem. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Where can anyone go if they want to get in contact with you or look up your work? I know you also have a book.
I do have a website called brockbastian.com. You could go there, or just, I don't know, Google, or just send me an email. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for coming, Brock.
No worries.